against the common enemy of man.
Hello and welcome to another bonus episode of Teenagers with Attitude. I am your host, Dustin, and with me today is Jules.
Hi there.
And Eric.
You kill bugs good.
So, normally on these sorts of bonus episodes, we review other tokusatsu shows, or shows that are roughly equivalent to Power Rangers, which is technically what the main podcast is about. And since I'm the host again, you would expect me to do something hella anime, like I've done my previous few times. But nope, not this time. We're going in a completely different direction by talking about one of my favorite childhood shows, Roughnecks Starship Troopers.
I mean, you could 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon this to anime, aside from the direct anime adaptation.
That's true. Yeah, it did have an anime adaptation. That's not the one we're talking about right now, partly because, you know, weirdly enough, I have never watched that one. You'd think I would, but no.
Starship Troopers had mobile infantry. The mobile infantry inspired the mobile suits from Gundam. Therefore, close enough.
And yeah, that's a bingo.
2 degrees.
Yeah, I could probably connect it to Macross too if I really wanted to, but yeah, Roughnecks is an interesting show, like a lot of Starship Trooper stuff, actually. It's one of the many adaptations of the original Starship Troopers novel written by the famous science fiction author Robert A. Heinlein. Starship Troopers is easily his most well-known work, and also probably his most controversial. While Heinlein himself has stated that the book is meant to glorify the rank-and-file soldiers, not war itself, and serve as an exploration of various political and moral arguments about how a society might function, plenty of readers found the book to be troublingly pro-fascist, an argument supported by, among other things, the protagonist's views on capital and corporal punishment and voting being restricted to those who have completed federal service. One of those critics actually was Paul Verhoeven, who ended up directing the Starship Troopers movie adaptation after a script called Bug Hunt at Outpost 9, which, that's a pretty B-movie as hell title, let me tell you.
That's a great title.
Did that get turned into, like, the second Starship Troopers movie?
I'm not
God,
actually,
I would be surprised.
I don't know if it got a more close... I'm not sure if the second Starship Troopers was closer to what it was supposed to be, but
no,
that script...
No, it wasn't. I've seen those sequels. They're bad. They're really bad.
Okay.
They're really
yeah,
bad.
Yeah, the third one is, like, it almost goes around the corner of bad to good, but it's still pretty rough.
They get
They get weirdly preachy in a religious way.
Yeah. I've seen the third one,
it almost turns into Warhammer 40K.
Almost. Almost.
Yeah. But so that script got tweaked so the Starship Trooper's name could be licensed and slapped onto it. And to prepare for that change, Verhoeven tried to read the book, which he had never actually read before. And there's actually a pretty great quote from him where he says, "I stopped after 2 chapters because it was so boring. It is really quite a bad book. I asked Ed Neumeier to tell me the story because I just couldn't read the thing. It's a very right-wing book." And that opinion isn't too surprising, given that Verhoeven grew up in German-occupied Holland at the age of six, was held up at gunpoint by Nazi sympathizers. So he has a fairly low tolerance for fascist propaganda.
As one probably should, but yeah, that's as good a reason as any, Christ.
Yeah, so instead of being a straight adaptation of Starship Troopers, Verhoeven ended up making his adaptation into a blatant satire of the xenophobia, jingoism, and Nazi-esque fascism that Heinlein's critics saw his book espousing. You might be wondering why I'm going so deep into this background, but it's because it's kind of important to understand why this show exists and how it exists. Because at first blush, it's kind of a weird choice for a show aimed at, like, adolescents and teens. But it also explains, like, why the show made certain creative choices. For example, even though much of the political discourse that was in the Starship Troopers novel, and also to a certain extent the movie adaptation, it still has a pretty clear political message at its core. Unlike other kids' shows that featured the military, like G.I. Joe, most famously, Roughnecks depicted war as tough, ugly, and brutal. The protagonists were all likable, or at least sympathetic, but also had realistic character flaws, such as various prejudices like we see in the first episode. You might want to hang out with them or even be like them, but you definitely never want to be in their shoes fighting a seemingly endless battle of attrition. Unfortunately, the show also had a pretty troubled production.
Oh, yeah.
Largely stemming from one major mistake made early on. Episodes of the show were sold as strip syndication, meaning 4 to 7 episodes airing every week, before more than 6 episodes were actually completed. The lack of a decent backlog of episodes, combined with how time-intensive CGI animation is, meant that stations that aired Roughnecks were forced to either air a lot of repeated episodes or drop the show entirely. Because of this, the production schedule was so tight that the main animation studio, Foundation Imaging, wasn't able to keep up, and Sony was forced to contract multiple CGI animation studios. But even that wasn't enough to keep up to a strip syndication episode. Strip syndication schedule. So 4 of the 40 released episodes were clip shows that relied heavily on footage that was already used. And despite all those attempts to make things work out, it still ended up being canceled 4 episodes before the finale, leaving the story on a pretty big cliffhanger. Greg Wiseman, who I actually noted before we started recording, also worked on Young Justice and more recently Star Wars Rebels, was a story editor for what would have been the finale, and he later released an outline of what would have happened during those final episodes. So fans got a small amount of closure, but it's kind of a bad note for an otherwise pretty solid show to end on.
Yeah, it was really disappointing that there's just no closure whatsoever. Like,
yeah, no.
It's a metaphor for war.
Shit!
It was the plan all along. But no, it was... Like, I remember when I was a kid, like, I religiously followed the show. I think it aired on... it aired on several different places, but the one I caught it on was Foxbox, I believe it was called. Which was Fox's, like early morning animation block. Yeah, it was probably on WB as well. But I think it came on before Monster Rancher.
Here it was definitely on a network we had called Fox Kids, which was basically the TV channel that aired stuff like Digimon, Monster Rancher, other like dated 3D animated show Heavy Gear, as well as this.
Yeah, yeah. So roughly the equivalent of what I watch it on then.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. I associate it with most closely with the Men in Black animated series.
Yeah, yeah. Both it and Men in Black tended to skew more mature, like not adult oriented, but still like going after the sort of preteen demographic who are are more ready for more violent, more down-to-earth moral topics, I guess you could say. But it's definitely the case that Roughnecks tried to be very different from a lot of kids' shows. And it's easy to see this from early on in the first episode.
Even the opening is, like, quite stark in comparison to what you would find for most kids' shows. You could almost call it, to a sense, like, austere in a certain way.
Yeah. Yeah, it very much is. Like, there's not a rundown of the cast of characters. There's just a remix of, gosh, I'm trying to remember what the original tune is called. Like, it is immediately recognizable.
Yeah, like, anyone who's seen the show knows this theme song.
Yeah, but, yeah, it's very much a military march song.
You're in for a treat when the very first audio clips you get are JFK's inauguration and the announcement of the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sets the tone immediately.
Like,
I
found it almost is like the opening cutscene to, you know, an RTS around that time.
Yeah, actually, you could probably draw parallels between the tone and look of this intro to something like StarCraft.
Yeah, or even, like, you know, more futuristic Command and Conquer, like...
Yeah. And, like, let's be honest, StarCraft, especially the Terrans and the Zerg, like, they're obviously heavily influenced by Starship Troopers just in the first place. So it makes sense that there'd be that overlap and sort of feeding off each other artistically. But yeah, so you have the fairly, like, it doesn't even really do a character rundown, which is fairly typical of a kids show intro, or even of just intros in general. Like, they show the faces of all these people. Yeah. Yeah, there's no lyrics, there's no words on top of the intro, except for the title at the very end. Yeah, it's going for a very stark sort of intro.
Very much feels almost like, kind of like war footage in some ways.
Yeah, which makes sense because of how this show is framed. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like what I think is actually pretty funny is the very first thing they start the show with after that intro is a clear clear homage to Paul Verhoeven's iconic scene in his movie of the clearly satirical "I'm doing my part" propaganda video put out by SICOM.
God, that is such a good moment in the film, and it's still done really well here for the most part.
Yeah, yeah, like the animation is rough by today's standard.
Oh,
but
yeah,
like it still perfectly gets the message across.
Mm-hmm. Was it rough by that day's standards also?
No, it was pretty much on par.
Yeah,
and
what you would expect from a television show.
Well, and, like, honestly, I feel like the actual facial movements and the expressions, like, I feel those are actually fairly good for that time and still mostly hold up.
Yeah, they're actually not too bad. They get across the character's, like, actual tone and emotion quite well. It is mostly just, like, what the arms do.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, there's actually a... Yeah, because there isn't a lot of facial detail because of how primitive CGI was at the time. They mostly rely on body language, and it works pretty well, actually, where sometimes I forget that the animation is pretty primitive, actually.
But even then, like, they do, like, background and landscape shots really well. Like, it's still pretty decent. It holds up better than I expected. It holds up better than compared to, say, Heavy Gear, which, God.
Yeah. Or even, say, Reboot, which has... And, like, Reboot even has the sort of leeway of not trying to depict anything realistic.
True.
But, yeah, so, like, immediately following that propaganda video, we get the narration, framing device of the character we'll eventually learn is Higgins, who is a reporter, sort of talking over footage of these ships flying around and giving us our backstory of the bug war and how things are supposedly okay now and we've beaten the bugs back. And it lends an immediate tone of sort of serious documentary, and it's not going to be like this lighthearted, super fun adventure romp.
No, this isn't like your, you know, color-coded team of heroes taking out the evil bugs. This is like, this is a bunch of grunts that are going to, you know, get hurt a lot, probably.
Yeah, like, Higgins himself even says during the narration that, like following the victory over, the initial victory over the bugs and the whole propaganda video push, like, a bunch of people around his age signed up because it looked cool and fun, but never thought they'd see, like, actual on-the-ground combat.
And even just his tone indicates, like, he doesn't even like that. Like, at least in retrospect from future Higgins' point of view, like, just the way he brings it up is, you know, I really appreciate the fact that he points out, like, it shouldn't be seen as cool to just sign up for this shit. Like,
yeah, and that's definitely one of the benefits of having a narrator, of having this framing device where Higgins is clearly talking about this in the past tense from some point in the future after all these events are over, where he's able to look back and sort of give the audience a running commentary of his own thoughts and add kind of a contrast to the events that are happening. And it gives the writers more flexibility in controlling tone and dramatic irony.
Yeah, I like that they start with the rah-rah, sis-boom-ba, let's go get 'em, and then immediately goes into somebody who's actually experienced it and is disillusioned with it. Mm. Like, it's not a series that's trying to sell kids on war, necessarily.
If anything, it's trying to tell these stories.
Yeah, yeah. Right. That's very a consistent thing with the show, which is part of what makes it so unique. And I mean, like, this thing started airing in, I believe it was 2000. Oh, actually, sorry, 1999. And 2 years later, September 11th happened.
God, so, this was pre-9/11, wasn't it? Holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was, like, it was shockingly relevant to things that would happen very soon after it aired.
When he's going through that beginning narration, it's kind of like, oh, that almost sounds a little familiar.
Yeah, like, yeah. targeted, like, at the kind of demographic who would have a lot of their history shaped by that sort of event. So, like, I definitely remember looking back on Roughneck sort of after the fact and thinking, like, and, like, seeing parallels between it and the war we eventually got into post-9/11. And it's something I think about and sort of, like, appreciate more as an adult, I think, than I did as a kid, even though I still enjoyed it when I was a kid. But I appreciate it more on an intellectual level now than I did then.
No, definitely. It was at least good that at least one show was definitely trying to, you know, show kids this one pretty specific lesson about war in general and just even how the media controls it and everything through one character, especially.
Yeah, uh-huh. And so, yeah, so let's going through. So we have the narration, we have the troopers going out on their first assignment, and here is where we're introduced to who are going to be our main cast of characters. We have Bruto, who's kind of the big lughead of the series. You always got to have one of those guys. You have Doc, who is the prototypical black comedic relief character. Though at least in Doc's case, he's actually really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's kind of like Rhinox.
Yeah, yeah, actually he is a lot like Rhinox from Beast Wars, now that I think about it.
What does that say about Rhinox?
I don't know.
Don't want to get into that, actually. Let's move on.
But yeah, and then you have, like, the green troops who are Rico, who's going to be our main protagonist, Dizzy, who, interesting side note, in the Starship Troopers book, there were no female Marines, because in the Starship Troopers books, women were not allowed to join the military, whereas Verhoeven actually gender swapped some people.
Well, there weren't female Marines, but there were female pilots.
Yeah.
In the book, females are actually preferred as pilots because some reason is like they have better reflexes and they're able to control the ships better than men.
Yeah, some of that's actually one of the, if I was doing a more in-depth look at Heinlein himself, I would probably do a piece on how Heinlein has like both Heinlein's version of feminism is kind of problematic in certain aspects.
It's the same way, like, maybe don't ascribe certain, I don't know, physical genetic benefits to one specific group of people, because even then that gets really fucking weird. It's the, I always have felt this way about it, just because it's, with me personally, being Chinese, it's been the old ditty of, Asians are good at maths.
Yeah, it's that same sort of thing, like, where positive, quote-unquote positive stereotypes, like, yeah, Asians are good at math, or black people are good at sports, like, are still, like, harmful stereotypes, regardless of whether or not they're positive. So, yeah, that Heinlein had that thing going on in terms of women in his books, but, yeah, that's... I didn't really want to make this episode all about Heinlein, because that also is a whole bag of worms.
In the book, Flores dies in the first chapter.
Yeah, I seem to remember that Jenkins also dies pretty early on in the book, whereas he lasts for quite a while in the series.
Is this the start of the whole, like, because... This is just a trend I've noticed, that any private named Jenkins in any sci-fi military story kind of dies real fucking quick.
That's a good question. I'm not sure. Like, it wouldn't surprise me.
Because then, like, often...
It even extends to fantasy with Leroy.
I mean, like... I guess just because I'm a huge Halo nerd and Halo came after this, and Halo obviously borrowed a lot from not only Aliens but Starship Troopers... This straight up the famous Private Jenkins moment of him, like, dying badly. Like, going in a real bad way.
Yeah.
And just Jenkins is kind of like, if you got a soldier named Jenkins in your, you know, either not too distant future or super future military novel, you're kind of screwed. Like.
Yeah, you're fodder boy.
James T. Redshirt, like.
Yeah. Then we're introduced to, eventually, we're getting back to the show itself. We're introduced to Higgins, who he himself notes that he was never trained to be a soldier. He's just an embedded reporter. So he only has, like, the basics of combat. And even then, he doesn't... Even in this episode, like, he doesn't pick up a gun ever. He stays on the sidelines, just pointing his camera at things.
I mean, it's very much the case where, like, weirdly enough, kind of... Yeah, it's not like... This concept was invented during the war that happened after 9/11, but very much prescient for all the embedded reporter stories that came after 9/11.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, for example, the most famous example would probably be Generation Kill.
Yeah. And then, like, you get immediate character building, too, between Dizzy and Rico, where Dizzy's like, yo, this is our first drop, man, aren't you excited? And Rico's like, no, not really.
Like, yeah, you're gonna be dropped, like, out of fucking low orbit. Like, this ain't fun.
Yeah, and then Rico, like, makes doe eyes at the lady pilot, who we don't get a name for yet.
We don't get any dialogue from either, as well, like...
Yeah, she becomes a big player later on in the series, but, yeah, we merely get a flashback sequence of Rico being totally into her at the academy.
And oh boy, let me tell you, we talked about how the animation, for the most part, holds up. It's still quite dated, but it really shows in the graduation scene when they're not in any, like, armor or uniform, and they're just in regular, like, gowns and clothes, and stuff looks bad.
Like, yeah, it looks like Second Life.
Oh god, it does! Shit!
Well, now I can't unsee that.
Yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, let's get ourselves a Monster
Look
Factory.
Look for the boy mayor.
Yeah, Monster Factory, Roughnecks edition.
What,
the bugs are
going to
drop a dick
Totino's
bomb on
Psycom
headquarters in Second Life?
Yeah, sure. I mean, There are some bugs that look like dicks. Just straight up, like the artillery ones, for example, but...
I like that there's a group of students over Carmen's right shoulder. They don't move at all, but at least they have the excuse of, oh, they're posing for a picture.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, it's like, okay.
But even like, the way Carmen's pose is like she's front and center of the frame, like everyone else is often groups around her, and it looks like it's looking like she's posing for something, but we never see what. And cuts back to Rico and I guess Jenkins together, just like watching.
Yeah,
just like
yeah, Jenkins is going like too rich for your blood.
Yeah.
Which like that's actually. The more I think about it, there are actually some pretty clever lines, just like one-note lines in this series that hint at little background things. Like Jenkins' line to Rico, who is a Filipino, Filipino-American living in Buenos Aires. So, like, they immediately hint at some classist stuff.
Well, I think in the case of Rico's ethnicity, it's been the case where he was originally Filipino. I think in this show, he's not actually Filipino?
No, I believe he is. Let me check, because
it's been noted that he's portrayed, like, both in the movie
okay,
and
no,
this,
you're
yeah,
right. Okay.
He's portrayed as Caucasian Argentinian.
Yeah, okay, yes. Yeah, Asian Filipino in the novel, Caucasian Argentinian in living in Buenos Aires in Roughnecks.
Yeah. In the movie, it's more depicted like it's a class barrier mostly because of, like, you know, he comes from a family that doesn't serve, so...
Yeah, but still, like, yeah, so, like, he's one of two very clearly not Caucasian people in the, I should say, one of two very clearly not white people in the group.
At the very least, like, his name is Rico, like, it's definitely not...
Yeah.
It's not the most white name.
Yeah, he's not Ted.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it's it then gets like after the flashback, it gets to the drop sequence of the launch sequence of the dropships, and man, I always love drop sequences in sci-fi series. This one especially reminded me a lot of Babylon 5, which is a show I watched a ton of as a kid.
Oh yeah.
Like, I would watch that show with my mom a lot, and honestly, the aesthetics of this show also, like, remind me a lot of Babylon 5.
It's really funny seeing this and, like, again, being a huge Halo nerd after the fact and going, wow, Halo really fucking took inspiration from this show, I'm sure, because...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, a lot of... Yeah, it's interesting going back to Starship Troopers because you start to realize just how much modern sci-fi owes that whole weird franchise of things to its aesthetic.
Yeah, Eric briefly
because
mentioned
it's,
that, you know, like, the original book inspired Mobile Suit Gundam, which itself became a huge hit and became a huge inspiration to other, you know, sci-fi properties.
Yeah, because, like, in contrast to a lot of other sci-fi that was coming out at the time, like, it was, like, it presented a very heavily industrial aesthetic. Like, the ships in Starship Troopers are not sleek, they're not fantastical, they're very sort of realistically and gritty, sort of boxy. They look like space trucks.
Yeah, it's kind of like space brutalism.
Yeah, yeah.
Original trilogy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and like again, like Babylon 5 took a lot of. Specifically, I'm thinking of the not necessarily the space station itself, but the fighter ships, whatever space fighters, and the capital ships of Babylon 5 had that sort of chunky utilitarian aesthetic. Halo has. A lot of that aesthetic with the human technology.
Halo straight up, I think...
Aliens.
Yeah, definitely. Aliens played a big part in that as well. Just
yeah, Aliens, absolutely.
But, like, Halo 3 straight up kind of copies this dropship sequence. Like, because it does the whole thing, because in this first episode, it's the whole, I really like when they actually put the time in showing what a dropship sequence is in a show, or any sort of, like, because it's just, it shows that
which
there's a system
Gundam
in place.
Does as well.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know, it shows that there is a system in place and that this world feels lived in, like, people have, you feel like people have practices in simulations.
Yeah, exactly. It gives you a bit of background. It's like, oh yeah, like this is like an everyday.
Like
this
straight up, you know, they people. All they lock in. Everyone gets out of the hangar. They drop gravity down to zero. They then lock in the ships and tilt them at like a 45-degree angle, and then unlock them, and the ships just fucking fly out. Like,
yeah, yeah, it's great, and like it doesn't even, and it actually gets cooler later on. But before we get to that part, like, we have Higgins asking the requisite stupid rookie question.
Oh, yeah.
To Bruto. Who then gets to, like, do his, like, tough guy speech of, like, oh, yeah, the bugs are ugly
well,
shit.
Well, yeah, the question.
They'll fucking crush you. And then, like, Dizzy lays down a sick burn. It's like, oh, so you're, like, your face then.
Well, yeah, like, the question itself is just, like, have we tried negotiating with the bugs? And it's like, okay.
Oh, yeah, that's what he asked when Razak, their lieutenant, comes in.
Oh, yeah, what does he actually ask first?
I think we've all played D&D with this guy.
But yeah, so Razak comes in after Bruto's finished with his speech, and yeah, Higgins asks his dumb question of have we tried to negotiate?
It's like,
and Razak takes it all in stride, actually, and doesn't treat, and even though he'd probably be well within his right, does not berate Higgins for being an utter moron.
Like, yeah, like, we've talked about how, you know, this show deals with xenophobia and how there's some real jingoism, but no, the bugs are kind of like a ravaging mass of a swarm. Like, they're not...
Yeah.
We'll see, like, later there is a hierarchy and such in the series, but yeah.
Yeah, there is a hive intelligence much like ants among the bugs, but they're still basically just very large insects.
Yeah.
I like they had the little touch where Razak comes in without his hand attached at first.
I actually completely missed that the first time.
Yeah, same here.
He actually, like... I think to help reinforce, like, the bugs aren't to be reasoned with, he actually jabs one of them with his stump before going
over
and putting his hand on.
I just saw it, actually. Yeah, he totally just puts his stump arm against Higgins' chest.
It's also a pretty good contrast between him and Bruto, because, you know, Bruto is the sergeant. At that time when Higgins asks his first silly question, you know, Bruto is the highest ranking, you know, member on the ship, and he gives this whole boisterous, you know, speech that's full
Bruto's,
of bravado.
Yeah, Bruto is very theatrical with it, whereas Razak is, like, down to earth. And
yeah,
like,
and then Razak comes in as lieutenant, outranking Bruto, and he gives a very calm answer, but it's very much an answer colored by probably a very vicious experience.
Yeah.
Like that when Razak walks away, Rico's like, oh man, you should have got that on camera.
Yeah. Yeah, there's already, like, a lot of good rapport among these characters. Like, they're already playing off each other really well, and we're getting a really good sense of their personalities and how they interact with each other.
There's also a pretty good sense of, like, backstory that they give without it being too in your face. Like, the fact
that...
Yeah,
no one ever says, as you know, in military school.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's nice that, you know, we don't know why Razak lost his arm, but he's given this whole story about how the bugs are bloodthirsty and can't be negotiated with, and then he puts on his mechanical arm, and you go, oh, I can probably guess what the fuck happened. And, like, Dizzy is straight up just actually frustrated that she's seeing Razak again, and then it straight up just said, yeah, it's bad enough we got him in class. Like, he's gonna flunk me like, you know, now he's my fucking commanding officer. Like, you automatically know, oh, he was a teacher. And even Rico mentioning that he's got previous military experience.
Yeah, and then when Jenkins walked... Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, here's an example of Bruto with his dislike of the PsyOps.
Yeah, like that's where we get another contrast between the new bloods and like the veterans, where Jenkins walks in and Bruto's like, you know, goddamn psychics. And
because he's special ops.
Yeah, and Rico and Dizzy are like, yo, Jenkins, buddy!
Yeah, because, like, you know, they're friends from high school.
Yeah. And, like, there's another bit of, like, good sort of world-building and foreshadowing where Rico is like, oh, yeah, did you have fun eating steak with the generals at Special Ops? And Jenkins starts to go, well, not really, and then he's immediately cut off.
Yeah. It's funny the contrast between this Jenkins and, like, the Carl we get in the movie, played, you know, beautifully by Neil Patrick Harris, as, like, super cocky and confident.
Oh, man, I totally forgot that Neil Patrick Harris was in the movie.
Yeah!
I mean, if you had psychic powers.
I know, but, like, Neil Patrick Harris in the movie is very much just, like, cocky stride, he's incredibly confident. He doesn't react like a big deal when he gets, you know, pulled into Special Ops after, you know, he passes his exam. This Carl is very much, like, way more meek.
Yeah, he's kind of unsure of himself.
And rewatching it, I can't tell if they know that he's psychic. Like, I don't know, some of the undertones, it feels like they know he's special, but they don't actually know what's special about him.
It seems almost like the veterans have, like, a bunch of rumors they've heard about Special Ops, and one of them is just, you know, that they've got weird brain powers.
Yeah, whereas the rookies don't really know a lot. And it's also implied that, like, not a whole lot of people really know, not a whole lot of the rank-and-file soldiers really know what the capabilities of the psychics really are.
Yeah.
They don't have commercials for psychics on the news.
apparently not.
Not in this version.
Yeah, it kind of seems like the sort of thing that happens, like, you get recruited, like, when you join up for the military, and they're like, hey, we see you have some funny brain stuff going on. And so it's not really something you apply to. But yeah, then we get a outside scene showing them being fired on by plasma bugs from the ground, and they get into their totally sweet exosuit drop pods.
This part seems so unnecessary to me, but it's still really cool.
I mean, I can sort of get it, because, like, the dropships are pretty large targets, and they're very prone to being blown out of the sky, so they figure it's safer to just put each of the soldiers into individual smaller exosuits and just, like, fling them down to the planet.
Oh, but the, like,
so the way it works in the book is that as they would descend, parts of the shell that they go down in would explode off to create radar chaff to make it harder for ground-based weapons to fire on them.
Oh, okay.
And so they would keep on producing more chaff as the layers broke away. And then they would parachute at the last minute.
Yeah, it kind of does that in the show, but, like, mostly near the end, where you think it wouldn't be nearly as useful.
Yeah.
Also, the MechWarrior fan in me was always jealous of the... I'm just going to go ahead and call them mobile suits they have.
Yeah, I mean, they pretty much are. Like, Doc even gets his own sort of light mecha that has a machine gun and everything.
Yeah, it's Doc and Gossard that basically get to pilot the two mech units, which makes sense because in the movie, they're called mobile infantry, but they're all just fucking ground troops. There's nothing, you know, mobile about them. This actually makes sense where, you know, units get paired up with, like, actual heavy, you know, artillery and machinery.
Yeah. But yeah, I really like the sequence of the exosuits breaking up in the sky and then the soldiers using their jetpacks to slow their descent. It's actually a really good animation. It looks pretty sweet.
Yeah, in the book, they are basically like assault marines from Warhammer 40K, and that they're constantly on the move using jump jets and going all over the place, firing miniature nukes. Yeah, it's a little excessive.
So yeah, once they're down on the ground, we get our very first look at Pluto. And it's pretty desolate. There's not a whole lot going on Pluto.
It's a brisk minus what? 374
320
degrees?
Yeah, negative 328, just, I think they said, or something like that.
Tourism industry really took a hit when they declassified it as a major planet.
God.
Yeah. Business just isn't what it used to be.
I just got this one little, like, desolate diner with this one person going, man, I remember when we used to be a planet. Lots of traffic back then.
Yeah. Now no
just
one wants to come here.
A lonely gas station.
Everyone wants to just go inside Uranus. It's not fair.
Dustin.
What
do you think this is? Teenagers with Attitude?
I mean, it kind of is. Look, I gotta at least do something to keep us on brand.
As their entry into the atmosphere is there actually atmosphere? Because I wouldn't think so.
They're clearly still wearing their suits, and yeah, I mean, there wouldn't be atmosphere on Pluto because it doesn't have enough gravity to have an atmosphere.
They do indicate that, like, there are colonists on Pluto, so maybe there was some, like, you know, element of atmosphere introduced?
Well, I mean, it seems like the research station they show seems like a very typical, like, hostile environment colonization sort of research station where there are airlocks and stuff. So, I mean, they probably found ways of, like, making sustainable research stations, but I don't think they did any sort of terraforming.
Yeah.
Or at least I don't see any indication of that.
Probably wasn't the budget, both in-universe and in the animation.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, so, like, they don't show the entire thing, but there are clearly airlocks in place at this research station when they're going in and going through the station in a very, very alien sort of fashion. And I like right before they go in, you have Bruto doing a scan of the station going like, yep, zero life forms. And Jenkins is like, are you sure about that? Because I'm picking up some movement. And he's like, there are zero life forms.
It's just like...
Shut the fuck up, psychic.
And Higgins bravely offers to stay outside with the mech suits.
Yeah, which, you know, that's fair. They probably don't want him in the way anyway.
Yeah, like, he doesn't even have a gun. Like...
They put a Ace of Spades card on the right leg of Doc's mech.
I totally didn't even notice that.
I think they're kind of trying to play up the Vietnam type things.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, again, like this show is very much like about a large war of attrition that doesn't seem to have an end. So yeah, so as they go through the research station, it initially seems empty, and then bugs just start coming out of the fucking floors.
Like, yeah, it is straight up that scene from Aliens. Like,
yeah.
No doubt about it.
Yeah, specifically the one where they're like, they've barricaded themselves up and they have the sentry turret, and they're like, they just keep coming, man!
I will say, this is like, it's probably the one thing, outdated animation I can forgive for the most part, because it was the time, it was the fad, you know, I can understand that. The thing that bugs me in this point, it's the one thing that bugs me throughout most of the show, is the sound design of the guns.
Yeah, and also just the animation of the bullets, because both of them combine make the gun seem like laser. They seem like laser pistols, like laser tag course or something.
Well, the problem is, I think a lot of shows at this time, especially, like, I'm pretty sure this is almost the exact same sound effect used in Heavy Gear, just because, like, I think they're really trying to pull off the pulse rifle sound effect from Alien, which doesn't have a traditional ballistic sound effect, but in Alien it's got a lot of oomph to it. This one, it just feels very much like a pea shooter.
Yeah, I mean, in Aliens, even though it had a weird sound and a non-traditional sort of bang-bang sound that a gun would typically make, like, the impact came from the bullet's physical impact on the aliens and the sound it made when it impacted and the splatter of the aliens' acid blood and
there was
that
also
sort
like
thing.
There was like a you know, so, there was a sense of reverberation to that sound effect as well that you know gave yeah. it a lot more you know echo and boom to it. Meanwhile, this is just like I don't yeah. know. You it feels like it just feels so weak, despite the fact that the rifles are actually you know kind of effective against the bugs.
Yeah, like
I would like to go back and find the correspondence between the studio and standards and practice that said, okay, the sound of the gun can be this pitch, but not any lower, so it doesn't sound like a gun.
Yeah.
And you can't actually show shells.
But like, you can show tracer rounds.
It's just kind of a mess.
Look like yeah.
right.
And also, like, you can't show, like, alien blood or anything, and, like...
Well, they do kind of show a little bit, like...
Yeah. What's funny to me is, like, the bullets... The animation of the bullets looks so slow that it's almost like a bullet hell. Like, I can imagine you dodging the shots. Even though, like, no, they're like... clearly moving at normal bullet speed, or at least supposed to be. But the animated rounds are just moving at a snail's
like in
pace.
In the 80s Ninja Turtle series, Rocksteady had his giant machine gun that would eject shells... but would fire lasers.
Yeah, guns
so
and
like
kids shows.
Ridiculous gun laws that we can have in kids' TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
But that's it, apparently.
Yeah, so like I can sort of understand why it would be like it is because of standards and practices, but also it completely undermines any sort of impact the guns should have.
Yeah,
and
like,
so it often feels like the aliens are just falling over to pea shooters.
And then it gets tricky when you have a grenade launcher on your gun.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah.
Which, like, that, oh, that, no, does, no, that doesn't get muted in any way. Like, that's shown to no. be a fucking grenade launcher, but...
God. Yeah, and then Dizzy very nearly kills Jenkins immediately.
Yeah.
Friendly fire.
It's very much and, like... It's that stereotypical, like, you know, military sci-fi scene of she puts down the visor for, you know, heat vision, sees a red blob and shoots in direction and just hits the door right next to fucking Jenkins, like...
Yeah, and Razak, like, completely understandably chews her the hell out for that.
Yeah, like, don't just shoot at any random crap. Like, you're fighting bugs, but also you got people in the same, like, building as you.
Yeah, and then you have Jenkins giving Bruno crap for, like, oh yeah, no life signs, huh, buddy?
Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah, cool.
It seems weird that they have both the snoopers on, like, those are the visors, and they have the flashlights going.
I guess, like, because it seems like with the snoopers, like, you don't get, because it kind of washes everything out in terms of texture.
Mm.
So, like, it's hard to see, like, exactly what your surroundings are. Like, you get the heat signatures really brightly, but good luck navigating around the architecture. Whereas when yeah. you have flashlights, like, you can still easily find your way around a complex urban environment.
Yeah, true. That makes sense.
At least that's my guess for why they have both things.
I guess it is always just funny the fact that, like, no matter how far distant the sci-fi is, every Marine still uses a flashlight on their helmet.
Well, yeah, I mean, to be fair, like, you can't really improve much on a flashlight.
No, true, but, like, you think there wouldn't have been any advancements in night vision technology.
I guess not. Yeah. Who knows? Who knows? I'm not a flashlight futurist. But yeah, so they exit the research station, which has been completely cleared of all life, and then they find that they're about to be assaulted by a gigantic wave of bugs.
Yeah.
Fresh off of trampling the Lion King, they're making their way down the valley.
Yeah.
Oh. Jesus Christ. Now I want to see an old bug Lion King.
Who do we have to pay to do that?
I will say this is actually
holding up a larva at the beginning.
Oh my gosh.
Someone has to have made that. Someone has to have, like, done something along that line, right? It's the internet.
I mean, maybe, you'd think. I don't know. It depends on how big the Starship Troopers Roughnex fandom is.
I will say this scene's actually pretty good just because it's the first good indication of, like, how big a fucking bug swarm actually is.
Yeah, they actually do fit a lot of bugs onto the screen at one time.
And I'm glad they actually were able to recreate effectively how the bugs move, act, and sound from the movie, which was really cool. Like, yeah. It's really iconic.
Yeah, they basically just straight up use the exact look of the bugs from the movie as well as they can with their limited budget.
You can't really improve that.
Yeah, and like, rather than just shoot all of them to death, which would be impossible, Razak does the smart thing and has Doc, like, shoot an artillery round that creates a giant green firewall
across. Oh, yes. A giant wall plasma of minty round. Freshness.
Yep.
Yeah, they'll smell very good as they burn to death.
He just loaded that cannon with
their
five
weakness
gum.
Is spearmint.
Yeah. What if in the future that's what Axe body spray does?
See, instead of chitin, it's actually hardened tartar.
I mean, to be fair,
so
Axe body spray
up the tartar.
To be fair, Axe body spray is already kind of weaponized, so
this is
they
very
wouldn't
true.
Have to modify it much.
No, I would say the axe would be the bug coming up. If you've ever taken a can of Axe body spray with a lighter.
Oh god, no! I have never tried that insane thing before.
I mean, the closest I've seen it is someone in my science class, you know, because we had Bunsen burners and stuff, and pulling the lever on the gas tap on the disc and then just putting a match in front of it.
Yikes.
Yeah, he got detention for that one.
Yeah, I used to take cans of WD-40 and a lighter and have fun with my action figures.
Oh god.
Oh no.
Oh no.
Oh, so you were like, what was it, Spike from Toy Story?
I mean, mostly fire related.
Oh, that's good. That's okay.
I think there was I remember there was a Dr. Octopus who had a particularly tough time.
Dr. Octopus? Tri-topus.
Yeah,
his arms have been fused together.
Tried to make a delicious, appetizing dish with octopus, and he's a little too scorched.
God.
Oh, no. I like how when Razak is on the radio requesting backup, the writers managed to come up with standards and practices friendly version of FUBAR.
God, this... I forgot about this, and I fucking busted a gun.
Alpha team to Blue Leader. Come in, Blue Leader.
Whoa. Watching the war on TV is a whole lot different than living it.
We have an RDDD. Do you read?
RDDD. That's code.
Yeah, really deep doo-doo.
RDDD, which as Bruto explained, stands for really deep doo-doo.
It's like, come on. Like,
yeah, it seems like something these guys would say.
Yeah, which, like, it's one of the few lines in the show that kind of takes me out of it and reminds me that, oh yeah, these people are on a kid's show.
But I am glad, like, they never really say it, like, the full version of it out loud anymore, but it's just funny straight after hearing Bruto say, in a really deep, gruff voice, really deep doo-doo, that the operator on the other end of the, like, radio channel, like, says all the teams are RDDD, like, in a super serious voice.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, as if, like, yeah, standard military code talk is just to say doo-doo, like...
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's in the
one
manual.
One of the things that keeps catching me off guard is they... Like, I don't know if they're having to stretch scenes for time, but they'll just randomly cut to animation that looks like it's slowed down by half.
Oh, yeah, I did notice that with, like, Hagen's reaction shot to the acronym explanation.
I mean, just that fucking explanation. Sorry, just, I don't know. It's like hearing someone say, sorry, Lieutenant, we can't send reinforcements. Things are real poopy down there. Like.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, things are real poopy, gosh dang it. Sure is one tough pickle.
God. Oh, so that's what OTP stands for. Now I understand the internet.
Yeah. Yeah, OTP, one tough pickle.
I almost wish there was like a Dukes of Hazzard.
What's your favorite
tough
pickle?
These boys better start flapping their arms or grow some wings.
Then we have Razak, like, giving his, it's like, oh, the bugs were waiting, sort of thing. Where, of course, Bruto's like, are you kidding me?
One of my favorite lines from the movie is still, a bug that thinks, frankly, I find that offensive.
I just like that fucking mentality of, like, our enemy can't possibly think whatsoever, right? It's not like they set up complicated artillery firing positions to take down our ships, right?
Yeah.
It's like, Bruto, just come the fuck on. Just admit that there's some sapience to these things, God.
Yeah. And then, like, almost immediately after that, there's another line which, like, made me appreciate something about this show. And one of the other guys, I can't remember, oh, yeah, Gossard, who's in one of the other mechs, says there's something coming, and when Reza asks what, he says, an indeterminate mobile mass. And, like, it made me realize that, like, this show doesn't dumb down its language in terms of, like, complexity for its audience.
No,
which
yeah,
is something
like...
that I typically expect from, kids shows, or even shows aimed at teens, is that, like, the shows will often use fairly simple words, and definitely not something like indeterminate.
Yeah, I'm glad at least, you know, this show, when they use even that language, if they need, like, because they have a backdoor, you know, situation where, like, they know some kids will understand it, so usually have a character ask what the hell that means, and then they're able to dumb it down just a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, and, like, it, and that way they're able to still keep the language feeling like something an adult would actually say.
Yeah.
A.K.A. the Billy and Trini effect.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Except far less blatant.
No one says more phenomenal in this show. I hope not.
I don't recall. I don't believe so.
It was apparently in the last four episodes that never got produced. Just...
Yeah, yeah. They all actually get, like, Sentai suits.
Shit!
Yeah,
a bug exits the chrysalis stage and says, more phenomenal,
yeah,
but you can't understand it.
Yeah, shit goes down in those last four episodes. It's really crazy.
I think you mean doo-doo goes down, Dustin?
Oh, right, yeah.
Thank you very
goes
much.
Down. They talk. Yeah, they talk to Razak, who is a floating head in a jar.
Man, the war got real tough for him, huh?
Yeah.
I was going to say, if he was a floating head in a jar, I think that would be an improvement.
Oh, well, just, imagine that scene.
That's so
where,
mean,
like,
to Razak.
But imagine that scene where he's giving that speech about bloodthirsty bugs, but instead of putting on his arm at the end, he puts on his head.
Yeah. Oh man.
Nixon style.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, it's a. It's a.
Oh, let's go get those bugs.
It's got some sapience to it. Just.
Yeah, and so, like, one of the artillery flame spewing bugs appears, and they're like, "What the hell is that?" Razak's like, yeah, we've never seen one of those before.
I don't think it's an artillery bug, because I think it's a bit smaller than that, because...
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Because even in the movie, like, it's you've got the artillery bugs, which are fucking enormous, and then you've got, like, the regular big bugs, which are the infantry bugs, which are still quite large, and then you've got these guys, which are in the middle.
Yeah, yeah, these are more like the fire bats of the bugs.
Yeah.
These are the anti-action figure bugs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also like how when one of the mechs gets knocked out and Razak's like, status update, he just says, we're turtles. It's like, yep, we designed these mechs with absolutely no way to get back up if they're knocked over.
I mean, knowing, like, having been a, you know, kind of a bad military buff as a teenager. Honestly, yeah, I would not be surprised by that. Military hardware has no foresight sometimes.
That's totally not a surprise to me either. Because as we see, their backup plan is just having the other troops shove it back over into an upright position.
It's like a tipped over truck.
Yeah, it's like in Halo it's like in Halo where you drive your warthog off a cliff and it like upends itself and you just have the X button to have Master Chief flip it back over again.
I mean, you would think that at least the one Gossard is in with the longer arms would be able to ride itself more easily.
Yeah.
But I guess if it lands on its side...
I mean, it would have to have more than, like, 2 points of articulation in order to do that.
I mean, I'm just thinking of battle bots with self-riding mechanisms.
Oh, God, those...
Where they've just got, like, the two arms that can go in a circle to flip itself.
God, yeah. I don't think of... Yeah, you've just unlocked memories of BattleBots and Robot Wars in my brain.
Yeah, where eventually everything was just either a wedge or an anti-wedge.
Well, then you had the People's Hero Razor, which was a fucking pneumatic claw, which could destroy most shit.
Yeah, the People's Champion.
They've been trying to bring it back.
Yeah, not quite successfully, though, I don't think.
They didn't have Razor.
That's true. But yeah,
there was one team that was famous for bending the rules, and they were going against one of the spinning ones.
Oh, yeah,
and so they had like a little present as part of their mech that was like, "Ooh, just for you." And so, of course, the spinner hit the box, and it had a net in it that entangled the spinner and broke the spinner.
Oh my gosh.
And the other team was like, what the hell is this? And eventually they're like, okay, well, technically it's not against the rules, but it's against the spirit of the rules.
Fuck.
It was pretty great.
Good old BattleBots bureaucracy.
I still love that, like, the height of the BattleBots and Robot Wars arms race was just a wedge. Like, that was the equivalent of an ICBM. Like, just, if you had a wedge, you fucked everything up.
Yeah, changed the meta.
Yeah.
Wedge is too like OP. A progression of weapons.
A what?
We went from swords to muskets to ICBMs to wedges.
To wedges.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's the next tech tree upgrade in Civilization VI, is just wedges.
Yeah,
the trick
is
to fire
six.
Them at the enemy's door, and then the enemy can't close their door, because there's a wedge underneath it.
Shit, the wedge is the almighty tool.
Oh, no.
That's why the greatest pilot is Wedge Antilles.
I'm into that.
We have to move on. We have to stop talking about wedges. Yeah, so the dropship tries to pick them back up, but they almost get murdered by the flame bug. So they're like, nope, fuck this, we're out.
I can't really blame the dropship pilots.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Like, Dizzy is like, they're just going to leave us behind. It's like, I mean, you die anyway, so.
Yeah.
If you try to
get in
there.
Call us back when the doo-doo levels have cleared.
God. Yeah, we need a doo-doo level of, like, around 0.5.
This is Doo-Doo-Con 1. We need to go back to Doo-Doo-Con 2.
But yeah, so Rico comes up with a completely insane plan to jump on the flame bug's back and then throw a grenade in his mouth, which almost works. But not really, in that the grenade sort of, like, bounces off the lower lip and, like, blows out the tunnels underneath, and they all just go falling down beneath the earth.
I appreciate that his plan didn't work, because it would have to basically boomerang in order to go into that bug's mouth from that angle.
Yeah,
it was a completely appropriate utter failure.
But But, like, it's also good because compared to the movie where he rodeos the fucking bug and then shoots it in the back and then just literally football spikes a bomb into it.
All right, I forgot he did that in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, Rico in the show, at least at the beginning, like, he gets pretty badass at the end, but, like, in the early episodes, he's much more realistically green and not, like, a total super awesome soldier.
Yeah, he's a gutsy private, that's what he is at the start, which, you know, fits for the tone of the show.
Yeah. And Doc just stoically says, looks like he found the tunnels.
God damn it, Doc, I love you.
Like as he's just lying face down in the dirt.
Well, they don't even see him. Like, they don't even know if he's alive, because he can't respond to his radio.
Yeah. Yeah, and Bruto is just totally makes fun of Jenkins trying to get a psychic read on him.
Or,
like, I think the... Let's see, what's the exact line? Let me try and bring it up again. But yeah, Bruto continuing to be a complete dick to Jenkins.
Kind of a dick to everyone, frankly. Like...
Oh, yeah, nothing on Rico, but I see a pretty bird coming to fly us away.
God, he's such
a dick. Yeah, because now...
A reference to something?
Yeah, because, like... In a certain way, Rico's plan did work in that it got the bug out of the way so the dropship could land. Unfortunately, Rico can't really take advantage of the dropship at the moment.
And, like, Bruto's straight up willing to just leave behind Rico. Like, admittedly, they don't know if he's alive, but still, he's just like, now the ape is a goner. Fuck it. We out.
Don't let his sacrifice be in vain. He might still be alive. No, let's go.
Yeah, whereas, like, Razak is immediately like, no, we're going after him. Jenkins, Dizzy, if you're willing, you're with me. And they're like, shit, yeah!
Then my favorite moment, Bruto's complaining that going after him is insane, to which Doc replies, we're fighting bugs on freaking Pluto! We're all insane!
Yeah, it's easily the best line in this episode and makes me immediately love Doc.
Ah, we can't leave. We have a man down there.
With all due respect, little lady, that ape's a goner.
No, he's not.
Listen, nutcase.
Jenkins, Flores, I'm going in. You up for this?
One for all and all for one, sir.
Lieutenant!
Tell the retrieval ship to wait 10 minutes. If we're not back by then, move out.
Lieutenant's insane.
Hey, we're fighting giant bugs on freaking Pluto, man. We're all insane.
It is such a good balance of, like, good comedy and good self-awareness without breaking the actual show itself.
Like... And I like how the camera, after that line, just pans over to Bruto, kind of, like, glancing at Higgins, who's just very silently and patiently recording this whole thing.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, it's like, oh yeah, you're still here.
It's almost like, oh crap, I'm on camera. I better look like a good soldier and go down with them.
Yeah, and then, like, as everyone leaves, Higgins is, like, looking around like, I'm not going to just be around here on my own, so. Also, they have grappling hooks.
They don't really show it. They just show that they have them, like...
Yeah, like, it's never actually shown on their backs or anything. It's just like, P.S., they have grappling hooks now. Just Zelda inventory.
Like, fairly, it doesn't even look like they just have ropes. It's got, like, a pulley and winch system attached to it that they can ride on, like...
Yeah, which, I mean, makes sense. Because suits are probably pretty heavy. You wouldn't want to actually rappel in those things.
No, but also, like, it makes sense as well because, you know, they're fighting bugs. Obviously, they're going to have to encounter some tunnels and caves. So
yeah, I mean, they're on freaking Pluto, man.
Exactly. Like, they're going to encounter rough terrain. It makes sense, but it is still just like, where the fuck did those things come from?
Yeah.
Because they're not small, like...
I think it's supposed to be part of their backpack. I think.
Yeah,
or
probably.
Their jump pack.
It's just that, like, the backpacks don't have as much fidelity to show, like, everything they have on them.
It's mostly funny just because the animation of the show is pretty good at showing, like, oh, like, this is where they keep things, and, like, they don't just pull shit out of thin air. They usually have it on them to some degree.
Yeah, like, it's, like, particularly during this combat section where, like, they're killing the bugs, and then one of them, I believe, I can't remember who it is, but they sort of cock the grenade chamber and then launch the grenade. So,
and
yeah,
even,
like, there's
Riho's,
enough...
like, rifles attached to his backpack as well, like...
Yeah. Yeah, and Riho actually runs out of ammo in a very dramatic moment, because that's the only time you ever run out of ammo.
Yep.
I like the sound effect they have for it. It's basically a pneumatic drill.
Oh, yeah, it's like... Yeah. Rrr, rrr.
Like, well, I can't shoot them, but I can change their tires.
I kind of like the music that plays during this sequence. It's, like, particularly, like, the parts where it goes, rrr, rrr, like, there's, like, heavy, like, electric guitar distortion.
There's a lot of, like, musical variants in this show, because even before this, like, the scene of Riho running up to the big bug and jumping onto it and throwing the grenade, it's almost
Enya-esque. It was, like, dramatic... Yeah, it was like dramatic choral music.
Yeah, like,
yeah. There's a range in this show, and like, it doesn't always mesh well together.
No. Like,
I really want to hear Enya do a Starship Troopers album now.
Oh man,
Enya or Bjork?
Would be Klindathu flow instead of Orinoco flow.
Oh no. Oh, my mom used to listen to a lot of Enya back in the day.
But Paint the Sky with Stars is one of the best albums ever.
I listened to a lot of...
I'm a big
of
Enya fan.
I listened to a lot of Only Time.
Oh, God.
I gotta go with either Storms in Africa or Caribbean Blue.
I didn't expect anyone on this podcast to have actual Enya knowledge.
Caribbean Blue is a fairly solid song, yeah. I can understand that one.
I still don't understand what Cursum Perfisico is about.
I don't even know that one. You have beaten me in the Enya knowledge off.
Congratulations!
It's a weird,
I can
stuttery
see to you,
kind of.
I can see to you as the bigger Enya fan. Possibly the biggest Enya fan.
It's you, the big
no
Enya fan.
No matter who wins, we lose.
Yeah.
Okay. I also love the Adima song by Adima, because it used to be on the in-flight menu for Delta.
Wait, seriously?
I'll link it later. Yeah, it was like their company song for a little bit.
That's so weird.
Which I know because at the time I did a lot of non-ref traveling because my mom worked for Delta, so we got to hear it a bunch.
I was going to originally say you knew because you have an alert for whenever someone uses an Enya song.
It's...
The Enya signal's going off.
It's kind of like an Enya sense. It's like when you see the spider sense in the Spider-Man cartoon from the 90s. It's a lot like that.
Someone's singing really breathily along with the synthesizer.
Somebody's too shy to perform in concert.
this is just the Enya cast now?
Yeah,
sorry,
pretty
everyone.
Much. The joke is, honestly, I don't think I actually know, and I can name a single Enya song, so cool.
You wouldn't think that...
It's the new Enya cast. It's called Enya Business.
Oh, fuck. God.
Jesus Christ.
This is in your face and in your business.
You're literally killing me.
Yeah.
man. That makes me want to transition to JoJo's where Enya
villain. No. Not this time. No.
That'll be for later.
Is this a Bizarre Adventure thing?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not familiar with it, although I know of it.
Who would have thought that we would get to Enya from Starship Troopers, but here we are.
God damn it.
Anyway, let's...
It really has influenced everything.
It's true. So let's please get out of this Enya hole. But yeah, so the fight sequence ends when Rico does yet another Daredevil thing that actually works in his favor this time, where he goads the flame bug into incinerating a bunch of the other bugs that helps cover their escape from the tunnels. And Razak gives him his mandatory chew out of, like, you just disobeyed a direct order. That's pretty fucking gutsy, kid.
Yeah, the thing I always liked about Razak in this is, like, he is very stern, but then he's also kind of paternal at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not, like, a gentle dude, but he is, like, he's friendly, I suppose you could say, in his own way. Like
he's
cares
an authority
about his...
figure, but he's willing to, you know, admit when somebody did a good thing. It's not like, do what I say, no matter what.
Yeah, he tries to build his people up. And, yeah, it makes him immediately, like, likable. Especially when compared to Bruto, who is sort of Razak's contrast as a higher-up. And then we have actually a pretty nice narration at the end from Higgins going over what they learned and being like, yeah, so we learned a lot of stuff from this. A, that the bugs are definitely not defeated and they're only just getting started. And this wouldn't be easy. But also Rico learned that he's got a lot of potential and boy howdy will he need it.
It just makes me want to watch the rest of the series, really.
It does, actually. Like, upon completing this first episode, it reminded me of, like, oh yeah, this show is legitimately good, and I kind of want to watch more of it again.
Yeah, it definitely has a couple has a couple of rough spots, but for the most part, it's really good. Like, its rough spots are very forgivable for what they are.
Yeah, its writing is, like, really solid for a kid's show, and, like, again, the animation is a bit rough, but... the dialogue, even in the first episode, there's a lot of good stuff there. There's a lot of subtle world building. There's a lot of great character interactions. The characters are all immediately interesting, and you get a really good sense of their personalities. And none of them really seem like out-and-out stereotypes. The closest that comes to that is probably Bruto, but even then, he has a little bit of nuance.
Yeah.
So yeah, and like that combined with just how unique the tone of this show is and the message of this show is among other kid shows that were coming out. Because like, again, we said this early on, but this thing was airing in the same block that like Digimon and Monster Ranchers and I think like also, what was that show with the mecha that were animals that people battled in?
Zoids?
Yeah, Zoids.
God.
Fucking love
Zoids.
Zoids
is awesome.
Yeah, like, those sorts of shows, which, like, no shade thrown on them, except for, you know, Digimon. But, they were very lighthearted, like, battle is awesome sort of shows, whereas this was like, battle fucking sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, some of my favorite moments from this show are when, I don't remember if it's Gossard, it's probably Gossard, but the rest of the troops are kind of giving him crap because he's been in that mech suit so much, they're like, you're kind of forgetting what it's like to be an actual trooper. And then there's one where Rico is supposed to be landing on a planet, but he gets knocked out of the drop and he's just floating along trying not to die.
Oh yeah,
there's also the famous, you know, when they finally bring in like a robot as a trooper, that episode, and just it's a standard, you know, very typical episode about like, you know, does he count as a person or not, and like it's a pretty good episode. It's a good introduction for a lot of kids or like teens into that sort of that type of story.
Yeah, and even though like the bugs are just straight up black and white antagonists, they do get into the xenophobia angle with the Skinnies, who they later form an uneasy alliance with.
Yeah. Especially with, yeah, you know, even the character, the Colonel, Christ, what was his...
Tafai?
Yeah, Tafai. Just the fact that he was this once, you know, proud military commander, and now he's a private, who's been kind of integrated into a whole different species of a military, and treated really shittily because of the way he looks.
Yeah, like, it's a show that goes over a lot of issues that, like, you don't typically expect, or at least at the time, kids shows didn't typically do, but were kind of important things for people to learn about, particularly because, like, they're not typically subjects that you see parents really getting into with their kids. Like, you see animated shows, like, these days more willing to tackle those kinds of difficult subjects. But it didn't used to be the case. And Starship Troopers was one of the few that kind of led that charge.
Yeah.
Which is why it's a shame that it had such troubles. Like, I wish this thing had been more of a success than it was. I wish it had actually gotten to do its finale properly.
I kind of wish, just for the sake of it, you know, hopefully being completed, it had been done in traditional animation.
Yeah, I almost wonder if they had done it in 2D, if that would have helped a lot of their production problems.
Especially because it's not hard to do CG now. It's nowhere near as hard, but it's still a fairly expensive endeavor. But back then, it was, like, very much the brand new thing that cost a lot of money and took a lot of time, and I wish they almost played it safe with the animation.
Yeah. Yeah. On the other hand, there are some advantages to the 3D in that it does feel, like, despite its simplicity, it does feel more gritty and grounded than a 2D probably would.
Definitely.
So I guess the kind of question you have with a series like this is, if Netflix said, okay, we're going to bring this back for a 12-episode series, would you want them to bring it back, or would you rather keep it, you know, how it is, not have to worry about them trying to remake the atmosphere?
I guess it would depend on who was doing it for Netflix, because in theory, I would be all over that idea. But again, it would very much depend on the team they got to do it. But I feel like if Netflix were to do that, which, even though we're bringing stuff like Voltron back, I mean, Voltron's kind of a special case because Voltron was already, like, super popular. Seems pretty unlikely, but in this fantasy world where I get all the things I want, yeah, I'd be actually pretty stoked about that.
Soundtrack by Enya.
I think...
yeah, sure. Why not?
I think if it was going to be brought back by Netflix, it would have to be done the way they actually formatted the series on DVD, where they took each of the arcs on each of the planets and spliced them together to make, to make, like, the Pluto campaign and such. And
yeah,
turn them into
mini
movies.
I do like how they did that. Yeah, I do like how they did that. That each one was sort of a, kind of a mini-series that showed one complete story arc, like, in five or so episodes.
I think that worked really well, because then you'd have that, you know, 12-episode run of, like, these, you know, big arcs that actually got to be fleshed out.
Makes it tricky, though, because I'm watching it on DVD, and there's absolutely no break, so it just keeps continuing on to the next story. And it's like...
Oh, really?
Okay, I gotta wait for you guys to say which is the last scene.
Oh, huh.
You do, like, there is a fade out, so you do know when, like, you can pretty much tell because each of the episodes are only 20 minutes long, so you can go in 20 minute chunks, but yeah. It does mean you don't get to hear the opening over and over again, which is a shame because it's a really good opening.
Yeah, it is a really good opening.
And always, it's a
as
very
the
good,
listeners
it's...
will be able to tell because I've put it right before.
But it's very much...
Yeah, so right now, this is just a single track that's an hour and 36 minutes long.
That's super weird. They basically made it into a OVA.
Yeah, kinda. Like, it is, like, an OVA series of, like, 11 parts.
That's bizarre. But yeah, no, like...
I'll take it.
if you have never seen Starship Troopers before, like, it's definitely a show I recommend, like, even now. It holds up shockingly well.
Yeah, surprisingly, like, really surprisingly so.
Yeah, and it has the sort of, it's a nice balance between what Paul Verhoeven tried to do with his movie adaptation and what the original series was, what the original book was like, and that it has a very similar serious tone as the book does, but it is still a critique of the themes that were in the book. Mm.
I like, one of the things I like that goes across the book and the movie and the series is that these aren't just G.I. Joe super soldiers, you know, let's go get them. These are ground level infantry. They're scared before they drop, you know, they're scared during the mission, but they still get it done.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not like they're not yelling, "Go, Joe," and jumping out of planes. It's,
yeah.
Well, I hope I survive this.
Yeah, like, it makes them feel very, like, real people. While I was actually doing the research for that intro segment at the beginning, I wasn't sure where to put this, because it's something about the production of the movie, and I just found it super interesting and kind of tells you a lot about how you should take test audiences with a grain of salt. Because when Verhoeven was making his movie, when they showed it to test audiences, and I'm just going to quote straight from Wikipedia here, because this shit is kind of nuts and makes me a little depressed. But originally, it was clear that Carmen was torn between Rico and Xander. Test audiences, regardless of gender, strongly felt that a woman could not love two men at once, so scenes which portrayed this were cut. These audiences also felt it was immoral for Carmen to choose a career ahead of being loyal to Rico, to the extent that many commented that, in so doing, Carmen should have been the one to die instead of Dizzy. While admitting it may have been a bad commercial decision not to change the film to accommodate this, the directors did cut a scene from after Xander's death where Carmen and Rico kiss, which the audience believed made the previous betrayal even more immoral. So,
fuck.
Shorts, TLDR, fuck test audiences.
Yeah.
Let me see here.
Is this what happened to that Mormon colony that got overrun by bugs?
It doesn't say exactly where. Apparently it was stated. The citation is the audio commentary for Starship Troopers by Paul Verhoeven and Ed Neumeier. I would assume it would be an American test audience, though.
It would have to be, yeah.
Paul Verhoeven is American, and it was made in America.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was also made in 1997, so that kind of makes a depressing amount of sense.
Yep, pretty much. Ugh. Fucking test audiences.
But yeah, that's just, like, one crazy thing I found while I was researching all this stuff, where I was just like, are you fucking serious?
I mean, I can see how it would be weird to kiss after your other love interest just had his brain sucked out of his head. But
are you kink-shaming? Like,
well, they said, oh, she should have been loyal. No, see, they said that the directors cut that kiss scene.
Well, right. But I, like, was that kiss scene after Xander got his brain sucked out?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All right. Okay, I see. The grammar on that sentence was kind of weird. The grammar is kind of weird, yeah. So I think the intent of that sentence was to say they didn't cut the other stuff, but they did cut the scene that audiences objected to where Carmen and Rico kiss. Okay. I think
okay,
I understand
okay,
that,
that makes more sense now. Yeah, okay.
All right. Still, that's some fucked up shit test audiences. What the hell?
Again, though, not surprising, sadly.
Yeah, no. Which kind of just... is more evidence that Starship Troopers at its heart has always been like an extremely political series, like regardless of what form it takes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely watch the series. Like it is probably my favorite, which to be fair, like I haven't read the book. If Paul Verhoeven's criticism is to be taken at face value, I probably wouldn't enjoy it either.
If you go to the Google Play Store, I think you can get the first chapter, maybe first two chapters, as a trial.
Yeah.
It's the kind of book where it is very... It can be tough to read because it's intended as, like, a ground level... doing the tactics and all the preparation and you know, it's,
I mean, Forever War was exciting. Also kind of like that, but I really enjoyed that book. But also
I haven't read that one.
Yeah, but also written by Joe Haldeman, who also like critiqued Starship Troopers as like a glorifying war. But yeah, I should probably at least try and read the book at some point, considering how important it is, even if I end up disagreeing heavily with the politics of it. But yeah.
I mean, part of their preparation for drops in the book is they'll actually get, like, hypnotized and have, like, maps and stuff drilled into their heads so that they can react on instinct without having to stop and get a map. They can be like... Okay, yeah, I remember.
That's how hypnotism works.
Mm-hmm. That's weird.
Definitely.
I think it's supposed to be kind of like the, like, listening to
something
educational material while you sleep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Omelette du fromage.
Just one guy got the French tape by accident.
The eagle strikes at midnight.
Yeah. But yeah, Starship Roughnecks, definitely a great series and worth a look if you have any interest in like gritty sci-fi stuff. Yeah, I'm not sure. Do you guys have anything more to say about it?
No, like that kind of sums up. It really is just like a surprisingly solid show for what it is, and it really is just such a shame because going back and watching it now. Like, I had fond memories of it, and usually things I have fond memories for don't end up being as good as I thought they were when I go back to them. This was very much a case of, this lines up pretty well with what I recall of it in a great way, and it just makes me sad that it never got properly completed.
Yeah.
I mean, hearing about the production issues, I'm glad we got what we did.
Yeah. Definitely. Like, we were lucky in the end, but... It's still just a shame because there's not even a point of closure. It's just a huge freaking cliffhanger. Like, there have been plenty of other shows I've liked which have gone cancelled. I have a very special place in my heart for cancelled shows I love, especially animated ones like Motor City. But even shows have, like...
You and Rachel both.
Fucking Motor City was really good. Anyway.
Yeah, Rachel has promoted that series to me before, and I really should take a look at it at some point.
Yeah, definitely give it a shot, but it at least ends on a note where you go, okay, cool, it could very well end there.
It's like, that's a decent cutting off point, whereas with Roughnecks, it's time to get ready for, like, a big battle, alright, that's the end.
Yeah, things like Motor City at least got a full season, so they got the ending.
Yeah.
This was very much the case, just like, nah. It's kind of like, imagine if the Star Wars A New Hope just ended right before the Trench Run.
Yeah, it is very much like that, actually, where, like, this show ends right as they're about to try and take back the Earth from the bugs.
Yeah, it's like, nope, that's it.
it's such a gut punch. It's like, oh, come on!
Like, I don't know, it's kind of like, I keep bringing up Halo, but in this case I'm doing it to almost, you know, shit on Halo 2's ending of just, like, huge cliffhanger. I'm back to finish the fight. I've come back to Earth. Credits.
Yeah. So yeah, if you want, if you're interested in the show and want to watch it, it is like, aside from the DVDs, which I'm not sure how available or how expensive they are these days, but if you're in America, at least you can watch it on Crackle. Those it's legally free for streaming there. I'm not sure how well that works for people outside of America. I know Jules had some issues, but
yeah, difficulties.
But you also had a VPN, so who knows if that was what was causing the issues.
Well, keep that on the down low.
are you a cop? You gotta say if you're a cop.
You an internet cop? You tracking my cyber hacks?
Hey, what's up, NetNark?
NetNark? God, Dustin.
But yeah.
Hey, what's your homepage, 21 Jump Street?
Please speak into my helmet. Speak closer to the helmet. But yeah, so I can't guarantee how well it'll work for people outside of the United States. But, you know, at least Americans can watch it. And that's what matters.
And that's the true spirit of Starship Troopers right there.
Exactly. I'm doing my part.
Oh, God damn it.
And I'll proudly stand up next to you.
All right, so we should probably end this bug hunt right now. I've been Dustin.
I've been Jules.
I've been Eric.
Saying,
come on, you ape! You want to live forever?